People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note right here on Fine Music Radio. Today I welcome back to the People of Note studio, because I talked to him some years ago, the violinist David Juritz, who was born in Cape Town, began playing the violin at the age of five. He was awarded an associate board scholarship to the Royal College of Music, where he won the RCM's top award, the Tagore Gold Medal. And then on leaving the RCM, he joined the English Chamber Orchestra before being appointed leader of the London Mozart Players, a position which he held until 2010. He's had, as I say, a distinguished career, many recordings, many concerts, and many visits to South Africa. David, welcome back.
Hi, Rodney. Lovely to be back.
It is. It's good to see you again. And one of the main reasons you're here is because you're playing at our first concert of the season, where we haven't had concerts at the City Hall for so long.
Yeah.
So you're opening the season, aren't you?
I am. Well, and it's a very, very special night for me, because it's actually the first time I've ever played with the Cape Philharmonic Orchestra.
No, you joke.
Yeah, no, we tried to set up dates a couple of times in the past. It's never worked out for one reason or another.
I can't believe it.
So this is a big night for me. I'm really thrilled.
Right. And the concerto is Mozart's fifth concerto of the five he wrote, number five, which is the Turkish, which is quite a fiendish little piece, isn't it?
It's a fantastic piece, actually. He was just 19 years old when he wrote
it. Amazing.
It has this, it's called the Turkish, because in the last movement it's got the sort of Turkish episode. Don't forget that Vienna had been sort of freed from the Ottoman rule only not that long before Mozart was alive. So the Turkish music was very much in vogue, so he wrote that. But perhaps the most appropriate thing about this piece is that it's such a sort of lively, optimistic piece, and the Mozart marks the first movement, Allegro Aperto, which means open. And I just thought, God, you know, it's so great after two really difficult years for everyone to be starting a series with a piece of music which is just bright, lively, optimistic, and wonderful.
This Turkish thing is interesting, as you say, about the Turks and the Viennese, because it was quite a fashion, wasn't it? Especially, I mean, even Mozart with his Opera die Entführung aus dem Serail, bass drum, triangle, cymbals, but he doesn't use that in the violin concerto.
Well, he uses percussion. He gets the cellos to
hit their bows.
Hit the wood of the bows against the string, which makes a sort of clattering noise. You know, I mean, it's really imaginative. It almost reminds me of a story about Mozart, of Mozart arguing with Haydn. Mozart wrote a chord that Haydn would never be able to play, or maybe Haydn challenged him. So Mozart wrote this chord with the bottom notes of the keyboard and the top notes of the keyboard and one note in the middle. And Haydn said, you can't do that. So Mozart put his hands top and bottom of the keyboard, played the middle note with his nose.
Oh, my goodness.
So he was quite a creative guy. You
know,
he thought outside
the
box.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, all those jokes, a lot of them thanks to the film Amadeus, where he apparently used to sit upside down when he was a child and play the piano backwards. Things like that.
Yeah, we're just having fun, actually, which actually is what we should all be doing, music.
But the other interesting thing, David, about these Mozart violin concertos, I think he wrote them all in one sort of spurt, with the exception of one, but I don't know which one.
Yeah.
But he wrote them in very quick succession, didn't he?
Yeah, so, I mean, he must have worked so quickly. And as I say, I think you don't know exactly when he started work on them, but they've got consecutive catalog numbers, the Kirchhoff numbers.
Yes.
I think, he wrote them very quickly. And as I say, just in his late teens. But, you know, he also, as a composer, he would write a piece of music. He'd write the first section of something, and then he'd write a few bars of the second section of what we call the exposition, the first section, and then the development where things. He'd write a few bars of development section, and then put it in a drawer. And there are things like there's a fantastic string trio that he wrote, but we've only got a sort of page and a half of it. Because the way I think he worked, he'd have an idea for a great piece. He'd write out what he'd heard in his head, and then just a few reminders to remind, and then he'd wait probably till he got a commission to actually produce it. And then he put it in the drawer and say, right, I'll come back to that later.
Get some money out of it.
It's tantalizing because, I mean, of course, we know all the wonderful Mozart pieces that he finished, but they're actually even more that mm-hmm. he just gave us a glimpse of.
Rather like Schubert. He kept putting things in the bottom drawer, didn't he?
Yeah.
And not finishing things.
Yeah.
Famously, his Eighth Symphony. I read somewhere, I think, that these Mozart concertos, they might not be showy a la Tchaikovsky, but that they require a very special form of musicianship. You need to be a really good musician to bring these concertos off.
I think with Mozart, it's absolutely right. I mean, I think they're pieces which they need a lot of discipline, but you have to put all the energy and sort of life into them that you can. So obviously they've got to be played sort of tastefully and
elegantly,
it needs to sound
with grace.
Pretty elegant most of the time, but you've also got to be prepared to push the boundaries a little bit, so that mm-hmm. sense of playfulness, fun, and
like in the last movement of the number 5 that you're going to be when it goes all Turkish.
And I mean, you know, that's your chance to go wild a little bit, and it's fantastic fun.
And what about the cadenzas of these concertos?
I've done quite a few different ones over the years, but for this concert, I'm going to do the standard ones, which was written by the great Hungarian violinist Joseph Joachim, who was a very close friend of Brahms, and he wrote us a lot of really wonderful cadenzas. And I've played around with several different cadenzas over the years, but I'm for this one, I thought I'll go back to that.
Have you ever written your own cadenzas for these works?
I've written short, not for the concertos. I've written short cadenzas for other Mozart pieces, but I probably should get around to it. Obviously too lazy.
Well, it's hard work, isn't it, David? Yeah. What is your first piece of music? Is intriguing me. I can see the CD lying there. What is this all about?
Oh, well, this is a project we did checking the record sleeve. I think we recorded it in about 2018, And we recorded it at Abbey Road, in the same studio, the famous Beatles studio. And it's with someone who's become a very good friend, a wonderful New Zealand-born pianist, Alan Broadbent. And Alan's, he's an incredible musician. He's won a couple of Grammys and worked with all the greats. And he's done this fantastic arrangement of Dave Brubeck numbers with a string section, and he got in the London Metropolitan Orchestra, who I lead quite often in the studios, and that's made up of some really top London string players. I mean, they're all sort of soloists and chamber musicians in their own right. And I arrived at the studio on a Monday morning, and I said to the manager, I said, look, just let me know if there's any solos that I need to have a little look at. And I didn't hear back from him, so I thought, fine, I'll just go and have a lovely time with playing Alan's wonderful arrangements. Got into the studio and found this huge violin solo on. And then Alan came down and said, look, I just wrote you a little solo. We can record it now if you want. And I said, you know, Alan, I think I might take it home with me this evening, and we'll do it tomorrow morning. So I went home, got my son, who's very into jazz, who played through with me on the piano, and we worked on a little bit, and then we went into the studio the next morning and recorded. But it was just, you know, it was one of those kind of, you know, it was like a fantastic gift to be given a wonderful solo like that, because if you just, I mean, it's wonderfully written for the violin, but the string writing, if you just hear the colors that Alan gets out of the string sections, it's incredible.
So what track are we going to hear?
Sorry, I didn't tell you, did I? It's called Strange Meadow Lark, which was a Brubeck number I wasn't really that familiar with until then. Thank you.
How about that? Music by Alan Broadbent. Actually, this CD is called Broadbent Plays Brubeck. That track was called Strange Meadowlark. And you also heard David Master, who is the concertmaster of the London Metropolitan Strings, on the CD called Broadbent Plays Brubeck. My guest is David Juritz, a violinist who's in town to play with the orchestra this week at the City Hall, Mozart's Violin Concerto No. 5. But I just want to go back to this CD for the moment and ask you, just out of curiosity, what it was like being in that studio, the famous Abbey Road studio. Is it, have they kept it more or less the same?
It's actually protected by law. There's a preservation order on it, so you're not allowed to do anything else with it. And the rest of Abbey Road has been upgraded sort of at least two or three times since I started working there, but Studio 2 stays exactly
the same. Is it Studio 2?
Studio 2, yeah. It's the medium-sized one. It's quite a nice room to play in. The big studio, Studio 1, is actually a much, much nicer sound. But, you know, Studio 2 is what it is.
Is that the one where EMI does their big orchestral
recordings? Yeah, you do the big orchestra. But in London at the moment, there are two sort of major studios. There's so much work comes through London that we'll be in Abbey Road sort of two or three times a week quite often. But it's a fantastic place.
Did you ever see, hear, go into or play in or record in, how's that for a multiple question, Kingsway Hall when it was still being used, or was that way before your time?
Yeah, I was so lucky from my English Chamber Orchestra days.
Oh, yes, you would have.
We recorded the Cantilupe Songs of the Auvergne with Curator Kanawa and Geoffrey Tate conducting in the Kingsway Hall. And actually, that hall had an unbelievable sound. It was sort of built right above the Central Line, one of London's biggest
tube lines.
So you quite often lose takes or have to wait while a train rumbled through underneath. But actually, even then, it was worth it.
And what famous recordings have been done there? But you talked about the English Chamber Orchestra, which I mentioned for a while. You must have worked with famous conductors. You mentioned Daniel Barenboim. I mean, he's still very much up there with the greats at the moment, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He was, I mean, he used to come in every now and again. I mean, I remember one concert at the Festival Hall where he played two Beethoven concertos. I think it might have been number one and number two. And he was very, very close friends to lots of members of the orchestra. I was a very junior member in those days. But, you know, to see the guy sit down at the piano, and he said he hadn't played the piano for 5 weeks or something before he came. And he just sat down at the piano, and it was, you know, it was like watching a lion play the piano. Well, could play the piano.
Yes,
you know, just this absolute assurance.
Yes.
So calm, so authoritative, and fantastic as well. You know, he was an awe-inspiring, musician.
I know he makes some people cross in the orchestra because he apparently has got a bit of a temper and a bit of an ego. But I suppose when you're at that stage...
He could be a bit sharp, very direct. Yeah. I mean, I remember we used to do these music cruises, which were very nice. I got a trip around the Med in September, and then we'd go to the Caribbean in January. So it was quite a jammy. And then we'd be joined by likes of Barenboim, Isaac Stern, Gidon Kremer, Yo-Yo Ma. They would all come on the ship, and we'd do concerts together. And we were doing one concert with Barenboim in Santo Domingo or somewhere, and playing a Mahler symphony. Tiny orchestra trying to play the Adagio from Mahler 5. And I remember I sort of did something with Barenboim, said at the point of the bow, and I was at the heel at that point. And he spotted me and said, pointers are the end of the bow. You know, he'd be very direct that.
Yeah,
but I think that was the only time I got told off by him.
But you also said you learned such a lot from him.
Well, I mean, from musicians like that, and Murray Pirai, played in a lot of Murray Pirai's recordings, the piano concertos, Mitsuko Ichida as well. Going back further than that, George Malcolm, it was a legend from my father's generation. You know, and they would all be completely different in their styles, and being up close to them as well. You know, someone like the violinist Henrik Schiering, who, you know, I used to idolize, and we'd on these music cruises, we'd just go and sit in on the rehearsals, and Shearing would talk us through what he was doing. So it was a great experience to,
my goodness,
to see them.
One of the conductors, the English conductors that I've always absolutely admired, and I wonder if you've ever worked with him, was Sir Colin Davis.
Oh, Colin Davis, yeah. I did
his recording, in fact, sorry to interrupt you, David, of the violin concertos of Mozart with Arthur Grumio.
Yeah, oh, wonderful.
Is my favorite recording.
Wonderful, yeah. He was, Grumio was just incredible. Yeah. Now, Colin Davis, we worked with him a bit in the English Chamber Orchestra. I remember working him doing with the London Symphony Orchestra, doing Symphonie Fantastique as well. Yeah. He was one of those conductors that he wouldn't really have to say very much, do very much. He just made everyone feel like a better musician when he was on the podium.
And isn't that the greatest compliment?
Yeah, kind of alchemy. You know, he would just, everyone would relax and it would just work. You know?
Yeah, they are amazing. And I mean, Barenboim often reminds me, and some Barenboim fans may not agree with me, of Bernstein, where they are just so essentially musicians down to their core.
Yeah. Well, I remember we were doing some recordings with Pariah and with Schulte, where it was a funny little project where they were each conducting one another in a Mozart concerto, and played the Mozart double, recorded the Mozart double concerto together. And we were doing the sessions with Schulte, who was playing the D minor concerto, which has this very stormy, tense opening.
Yes.
And Murray was conducting. And Schulte was, wasn't happy with it. And so got Murray to start a few times, and it still wasn't what he wanted. So Schulte said, I'll show you. And he got up, stood on the podium, and he didn't really conduct so much as do a sort of slow motion sort of break dance. You know, he was making these strange movements. But there was a kind of electricity in the orchestra. And he said, you know, conducted a few bars, gave the baton back to Murray. Murray started, and it was all exactly the same, but there wasn't quite the tension there. And I have no idea how Schulte managed to do it. He could, you know, they could. It wasn't about getting at the same speed, the same loudness, even the same balance. It was actually being able to inject that sort of undercurrent in the music, which was really, you know, it was incredible.
But there are wonderful stories about Schulte, the London Philharmonic calling him the screaming skull because of his temper.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who, the thing is, you work with conductors like that. And, I mean, for instance, Jimmy Galway, I worked with Jimmy a lot. I'd spent 8 years leading orchestras with Jimmy, which was quite a challenge at times, you know. I mean, but the thing is, those people are so demanding of themselves, and also the reserves of sort of confidence that you need. You know, they're not always going to be that easy to work with. And also, you know, orchestras work incredibly hard. So particularly the London, the Symphony Orchestra, some of these heavy programs, lots of touring, lots of traveling.
And lots of film music.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the orchestra will quite often be really tired. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it needs someone who's a bit of a slave driver to kind of kick things back into gear. But actually, you know, you look back on the recordings and the concerts, and they were worth it.
We were lucky to have so many of those great conductors.
Absolutely.
And great recordings. Well, I think it's time for another piece of music. I see a disc here called Goldberg Variations Arranged for Violin, Guitar, and Cello, Duritz, Ogden, Hugh. What's this all about?
Well, that was a bit of a mistake, really. Craig Ogden, the Australian guitarist, he's a very good friend of mine. We've got a tango quintet together, and we do lots of duo and trio things together. But Craig and I have played a lovely concert series for quite a few years, and the promoter who organises it always likes us to bring something interesting. And we've brought so many different things there. We'd sort of exhausted all our repertoire. And I happened to, after the concert in about 2016, he said, can you bring something interesting back with Craig next year? And I said, well, I've been thinking of maybe arranging the Goldberg Variations. And I didn't really think about
it. No one threw up their hands.
Yeah, no. No, well, I mean, the Goldberg Variations, it was written for harpsichord. I'm being defensive here, I know, but when you hear it played on a piano, which has only got one keyboard rather than two keyboards, that's an arrangement side.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, but anyway, I said I was thinking of arranging it, and then forgot about it for about 6 months. Then I thought, around about 6 months before the concert, I thought I'd better just have a little look at this and start work on it. And I realized almost immediately it was just impossible. It was a terrible idea. So I rang up Colin, the promoter, to see if we could perhaps change the program. And he'd already printed his program for the year and sold tickets. And in fact, we didn't even get to the point of discussing it. He just, everyone's looking forward to your Goldberg variations.
Oh, gosh.
So rather than have a humiliating climb down, I thought, I better get on with it. And I mean, some of it was actually quite easy to arrange, and some of it was extremely difficult to arrange, and some of it was easy to arrange, but very difficult to play for, particularly for the cello and the guitar, because they have to play up quite high. But actually, I worked on it for about 3 or 4 years after that, and we recorded it last year. I think we're heading towards about 1 million streams in 9 months.
That's very good. Very good.
And it's, look, I mean, if I said I was pleased with the way it turned out, that's because it's Bach did all the hard work for me. But it's quite nice to have rather than just having three stringed instruments, to have the guitar playing, then you get a little bit of an echo of the harpsichord.
And no sign of a keyboard instrument.
No sign of a keyboard instrument at all.
Now, of course, I wonder, I think I'm definitely going to suggest we play the opening aria. What do you think? Because firstly, it's the most beautiful piece of music. And secondly, knowing it on the piano or the harpsichord, it's going to be fascinating to hear it in this combination. So are we allowed to do that?
I think that's a great idea.
Okay, so here it is, the aria on which the Goldberg variations are based, in this arrangement by my guest David Juritz, for violin with David, Craig Ogden guitar, and Tim Hugh cello. Thank you. Well, now, that's fascinating. How about that? That's the famous aria that opens the Goldberg Variations. And it was that arrangement by David Juritz for violin, guitar, and cello. David Juritz, violin, Craig Ogden, guitar, Tim Hugh, cello. It sounds, David, as though you must have worked very hard, but you've sort of captured the essential feel of the piece.
Well, it's, you know, there's this sort of trope that Bach can be played on any instrument. And it's all very well saying that, but when you're actually fiddling around with his music, you definitely feel him looking over your shoulder, you know. And, yes. And also, when Bach was alive, you know, the big musical debate of the time among composers was, would there be music in heaven? And it was agreed that there would be music in heaven, but only perfect music would be able to be played there. And Bach didn't really enter into the debate. He just wrote perfect music. And, you know, the deeper you go into the Goldberg Variations, when you start analyzing the form and what he did there, it is mind-blowing in its perfection. There's all sorts of mathematical relations that occur between movements. You can divide it into two sections, and they've got exactly the same number of bars in each half. And that's something which actually goes in his other music as well. So really, I mean, had I known what I'd learned doing the arrangement before, I would have never just casually said to somebody, oh, I'm thinking of arranging the Goldberg Variations, because actually it's, you know, you feel that you're tinkering with something which actually
you
deserves a lot of respect.
David Juritz is my guest on People of Note this week. He's playing the Mozart Violin Concerto No. 5 with the orchestra and Bernard Gurler this coming Thursday. And David, your repertoire, I have to say, seems quite wide. Do you play the Bach solo violin pieces as well, and do they say something to you?
Yeah, well, I've become quite a Bach obsessive, like most musicians. I recorded the sonatas and partitas, I think, in 2010, so And again, yeah, same story, you know, talking about perfect music. There's not only these, you know, astonishing kind of, I mean, there's a thing you can do as a musician. You're counting the bars in Bach, and you find all sorts of patterns in there. And then musicologists have done research where they found chorale tunes hidden within the pieces of music. And also there's a narrative right the way through the six sonatas and partitas. Is very much about man's relationship with God, and the first sonata, for instance, represents the nativity, the birth of Christ. The second sonata represents the crucifixion, and the third sonata represents Pentecost. And then you have three partitas which accompany them. And I think my personal belief is the first partita represents the creation, God creating man. Then the death, the Chaconne, the greatest piece ever written for solo violin, was written. Bach wrote in memory of his wife,
yes,
his first wife who died. And then the third partita represents heaven, the sort of reunification of man with God in the afterlife. So these sort of incredible sort of resonances that go through it. I mean, personally, I'm not religious, but I think most of us musicians, we do feel a little bit like playing Bach is a bit like praying.
Mm-hmm. And the cello sonatas aren't like that, aren't they? The cello sonatas, I should say. I remember someone saying to me, in fact, it was Richard Koch's wife, Susan Koch, who said to me that when you sit and listen to the Bach cello sonata suites, it's like listening to a very wise old man talking to you, and you sit quietly and listen to him because he's saying very important things.
Yeah.
And I love that when you listen to, because you need, as a listener, like the violin partitas and all that, you need to concentrate It's not the sort of thing that you're going to tap your foot to and sing a tune.
Well, I tell you, you know, it's good for your mental health, Bach.
Yes.
It really is. And I found it, you know, in 2007, we talked about this last time, I did this sort of busking trip around the world.
Yes, around the world.
Just playing Bach. And, you know, it didn't matter how crazy things were, how, you know, because that trip was, because I was busking, it was a disorganized trip. That was what it was meant to be. I never knew where I was going. I didn't, you know, it was quite a sort of struggle.
But it was a success, wasn't
it? Yeah,
yeah,
it was a huge success. I made it around in about 5 months. But I would find each day, it didn't matter how difficult things were and how uncertain things were, if I stood on a street corner, I played Bach for an hour, I would just be back in that sort of safe mental headspace. And it would help you, you know, really help me recharge my batteries to get on. So, I mean, every day, without question, I play Bach.
But also, you are very passionate, aren't you, David, about young people, about education, disadvantaged communities. You've done a huge amount of work all around the world, including here, Mozambique, South Africa, with that sort of thing.
Yeah, when I did the busking trip, we set up a charity called Musicality, which we kept going for, I think, 8 years. And we funded projects in Uganda, South Africa, Goa, Haiti, sort of, I think it was 7 or 8 different countries, but they were all aimed at underprivileged kids. And, you know, music is a great way of giving kids something that they can be proud of, giving them the chance to perform, putting some structure into their lives. And I've always said that, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, your experience in music is the same. And if you're playing, it's whether you're prepared to put the effort in, the work in, rather than whether you've got rich or poor parents.
What violin do you play?
I'm incredibly lucky. About 20, well, just a bit over 20 years ago, a friend rang me up to say that someone was visiting London with a very nice Guadagnini. Guadagnini was, he was a little bit younger than Stradivarius, may have worked in Strad's workshop. He was born in a town about 20 miles from Cremona where Stradivarius and Amati and all the great other great makers lived. So he's really in the kind of top flight of violin makers. Anyway, the squad came up for sale. I had a lovely Italian violin made around about 1750. So it was a proper piece of kit. but I thought I'll just have a look at the quad, played it a bit and thought, I need to have this violin. So we managed to buy it. And it's the most incredible instrument. It's, you know, it's one of those kind of instruments you can play really, really quietly on, but it'll project above an orchestra, you know, which is, it's kind of sort of magic, which those Italian instruments have, which is why all of us want to get one. And I've been incredibly fortunate.
Did you bring it to South Africa?
Yeah.
Okay. No, so we'll hear it on Thursday night.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's have some more music now, David. And I see you've chosen Cantaloupe. You spoke about it earlier, working at Abbey Road, recording this with Dame Kiri Takanawa and Geoffrey Tate. So it must have a special memory for you, because I know that this recording has always been highly regarded.
I suppose one plays on so many recordings. If you work in London, we record that all the time. But there are just a few recordings that the memory of being in the studio really stands out, and this is one of them. It was Geoffrey Tate's, I think, his first sort of conducting job. I can't remember whether the original conductor dropped out at short notice, and Geoffrey was a pianist at the Royal Opera House, but anyway, Geoffrey stood in at very short notice. And to me, what stands out about this recording is it's the wonderful sound of Kingsway Hall, as we discussed earlier. Of course, Kiri Takanawa's voice was made for this music.
Absolutely.
And then also there's the English Chamber Orchestras who had the soloists in the wind section. We've got the wonderful Neil Black on oboe, Thea King on clarinet, William Bennett on flute. And
quite a lineup.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, of course, they were all sort of recognized soloists in their own right. And they were also very idiosyncratic players, very individual, the kind of player that was immediately recognizable when you heard them on the radio or something. So I think there's so much sort of color in this recording. I'm just a little part of the string section, but
okay.
I'm so proud to
be part
of
it. You.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, David, I liked what you said. Kirik Tikanawa's voice was made for these songs. That was Bayero from Cantaloube's Songs of the Auvergne with the orchestra conducted by Geoffrey Tate. He was made a knight just before he died. Remember Sir Geoffrey Tate, and he then died a few
years ago. I know. So, he was just a wonderful guy, actually.
Well, I really like his recordings of the Mozart piano concertos, Mitsuko
with Mitsuko,
Uchida.
Yeah.
I really think they're great. Now, yeah. As always on radio, you tend to run out of time. But one thing I wanted to mention was, I remember when you were here years ago, you played the Four Seasons, Vivaldi's Four Seasons at various, and I remember really quite liking it.
Thank you.
But they say that your recordings of the Four Seasons, your recording released in Nimbus in 2012, is regarded as one of the finest. And that's quite a thing, because there's so many of those recordings about. But clearly they mean something to you, those four concertos.
Well, I love playing the Four Seasons. I have played it a lot. Mm. My wife says I must never tell anyone how many times I've played it, but a lot is a lot.
Okay.
It's music that you have fun with. Vivaldi invites you to experiment, to do, you know, anything wacky and wild.
And they're meant to be wacky and wild.
And
aren't they?
I love listening to new recordings of it, because, you know, every violinist comes up with ideas, and I think that, you know, they're all getting even more wacky and wilder.
Remember
as well. So it's
how Nigel Kennedy shocked everyone with his
first
set.
I played on Nigel's
On that recording.
Yeah. That was sort of towards the end of my time in the ECA.
That must have been an experience for you. Did you think, what are you doing? But you also do Sarah Beth Biggs. You've got this trio that you work with as well.
With the pianist Sarah Beth Biggs. She was, for many years, she was the youngest ever finalist on the BBC Young Musician of the Year, and wonderful pianist and incredible Mozartian player. You know, she's so we worked. We've got a recital coming up next month together, so that'll be the first time we've been able to play together for over 2 years.
Yes,
we tried to
pandemic.
Do a few things in lockdown, but it's you know, sort of remote recording, it doesn't it's such a compromise, and we just thought, you know, let's leave it until we can actually do it properly.
And you're based in London, aren't you, David?
I live that in West London. I was sort of at a stage where I was thinking, I could go back to Cape Town maybe, and then I met a very nice woman. And
that took
the rest
care of
is
that.
History. We were married very quickly, and two children followed fairly quick.
And are you fairly busy, David, as a musician?
Well, most of us actually we stayed sort of mediumly busy during lockdown. In fact, I ended up setting up a little recording studio in one of the rooms in the house, and we recorded some big Hollywood film. All of us recording the part separately to track. So we sort of kept going through that. The last few months have been very busy with the London Tango Quintet, which I have with the guitarist Craig Ogden, wonderful accordion player Miloš Milivojević. I'm going to try and bring them out at some point.
Oh, you must. That sounds
so lovely. We had a whole string of concerts in the UK. All the concerts that we should have done over the preceding 2 years were kind of condensed into about 5 weeks.
Yeah.
And things are, you know, obviously it's very up and down. People are still quite jittery, but I think things are starting to look quite busy for next year. So
this is good. Yeah. And it's so nice to have you in Cape Town. I hope you're going to have a bit of a holiday as well while you're here.
I thought I'd just give myself a few extra days as well before I head back to the winter.
Yes, of course.
And it's lovely to be here and see old friends, see Cape Town. I mean, I hope you realize how lucky you are living here.
Well, you know, you do tend to take things for granted, don't you? But right? Yeah. I'm not a Cape Townian.
You know, I've been lucky enough to travel quite a bit, and Rio perhaps comes close, but it doesn't have the sunsets. But I think, you know, Cape Town really is. You know, I know I'm slightly biased, but it really is the most beautiful city in the world.
Allowed to be biased. Yes. All right, well, David Juritz, thank you. It's going to be great to hear you on Thursday night with Mozart's Violin Concerto No. 5 with the Cape Town Philharmonic and Bernard Goerle. And we'll see you there with your Guadagnini.
Guadagnini.
Guadagnini. Oh,
I think Panini with Guad in front.
In front. And come again when you come and chat to us again on Fine Music Radio. We're next to you here.
Be back. Yeah.
And we're going to end actually with you at last playing one of these violin pieces by Bach. Tell me what we're going to hear.
This is the prelude from the Partita number 3 in E major. That sounds terribly formal, but I guarantee you everyone will recognize this piece.
Thank you, David. So we'll go out with that, the music of Bach. And my guest on People of Note this week was David Juritz. Thank you, David.
Great. Thanks, Ronnie.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions. FMR.